From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 12, 2008. The Treasury is poised to dish over TARP funds to the Big Three in an effort to avoid an auto industry collapse. A bipartisan report charges that Donald Rumsfeld is directly responsible for detainee abuse at Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, and beyond. And we wrap up our Human Rights Week series today and hear from New York and Brazil. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for those stories after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A new policy published by the Justice Department authorizes law enforcement officers to collect DNA samples of all people arrested for federal crimes as well as detained non-citizens. Sam Greenspan has more from D.C.
The National DNA Index System, or CODIS, currently contains DNA from more than 6.2 million individuals. The congressionally authorized expansion of CODIS could increase the number of DNA samples by 1.2 million, or about 20%, every year. Authorities want the additional data to help solve crime, but civil rights organizations, including the American Civil Liberties Union, question if solely getting arrested or being questioned about legal immigration status is probable cause for taking a DNA sample. Earlier this month, the European Court of Human Rights found a similar practice in Britain to be a violation of personal privacy. The incoming Obama administration will determine how proactive DNA collection will actually be. The rule change goes into effect on January 9th. In Washington, I'm Sam Greenspan.
In another last-minute rule change, the Bush administration has gone after 35-year-old regulations in the Endangered Species Act. The rule, finalized Thursday, eliminates mandatory independent scientific review on projects such as power plants and dams. It also says that environmentalists and other groups cannot use the argument that a project endangers animals because it contributes to global climate change. Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne argued, quote, "Nothing in this regulation relieves a federal agency of its responsibility to ensure that species are not harmed, but environmentalists see this as a further erosion of endangered species protections." Today, at least 25 school children died in a fatal accident in southern Nepal when an overcrowded bus skidded off a bridge and fell 75 feet into a riverbed. PC Dubey reports from Nepal.
The children were returning home after a picnic in the famous Chitwan Tiger Reserve. In addition to the deaths, over 60 schoolgirls and their teachers were badly injured and are undergoing treatment. But hospital sources fear the death toll could rise because some are seriously injured and not responding to treatment. Eyewitnesses say the bus driver became inebriated at the school picnic and was driving rashly. He was able to jump off the bus before it fell into the river. Social activists belonging to the group No Alcohol in Public say bus accidents kill over 2,000 people annually in Nepal. They blame drunk driving for many of the accidents. The group seek a ban on driving while inebriated that includes harsh penalties for violators. From Birganj in Nepal, I'm PC Dubey.
Following a week of violent protests, today the Greek prime minister rejected calls for a national election. PM Kostas Karamanlis cited the need for steady leadership during the global economic crisis. Protesters clashed with police once again today in Athens. Subway workers in Argentina went on strike today, shutting down commuter services. FSRN's Marie Trigona files this report from Buenos Aires.
The workers shut down Buenos Aires subway lines to protest what they call fraudulent union elections. The shutdown began early this morning and affected nearly a million commuters. By early afternoon, police had removed striking workers from subway stations and supervisors took over operation of the trains. Meanwhile, thousands from center-left union federations held marches against hunger today in cities throughout Argentina. Unemployed workers, also known as picateros, joined the protests, blocking a major access bridge into Buenos Aires. Organizers are calling for a government-implemented redistribution of wealth. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
In Montreal, tempers are flaring yet again about a police shooting death of a teenager last August and the refusal of the prosecutors to bring any charges against the officer involved. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more from Canada.
Last Friday, Quebec Crown prosecutors announced there will be no charges laid against Montreal police officer Jean-Louis Lapointe. Lapointe shot and killed 18-year-old Freddy Villanueva in a park in Montreal's impoverished North End last August. For Villanueva's family and supporters, this was just another blow in the case and sparked a large public outcry this week. In response, the Coalition Against Repression and Police Abuse, a group that formed in response to Villanueva's death, is holding a rally tomorrow in the very park where the young man was killed. The shooting death on August the 9th led to an entire day of fierce riots in the neighborhood. With 43 people killed by police in Montreal since 1987, many are now questioning the standard procedure of having investigations handed over to outside police forces following deadly incidents. This is Aaron Lakoff reporting for FSRN from Montreal.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Let the finger pointing begin. Republicans and the Auto Workers Union are blaming each other after Congress came to an impasse on the auto industry bailout. But President Bush and the Treasury may step in and issue the Big Three some $15 billion from TARP funds to avoid an industry collapse. Karen Miller reports from Capitol Hill.
With $14 billion on the line, Senator Bob Croker, Republican of Tennessee, says members of Congress came to the UAW with a three-step plan. First, working with creditors to pay down the company's debt. Two, reforming voluntary employee benefit accounts. And three, making sure union and non-union wages are comparable.
If we do all of these things, we would like for the UAW to be competitive, okay, with Honda, Nissan, Toyota, and BMW. By the way, those were companies the UAW selected.
Kroger says this was a part of the plan that became the sticking point.
I basically pleaded with them to give me something, give me some kind of language where we would know that at some point, date certain, they were, quote, competitive, not parity, competitive with these other companies. So that is where it broke down.
But UAW President Ron Gettelfinger tells a different story. He says it was the Republicans that did the grandstanding.
We've already stepped forward and made enormous concessions. But as we made it clear last night, we were prepared to make further sacrifices. But we could not accept the effort by the Senate GOP caucus to single out workers and retirees for different treatment and to make them shoulder the entire burden of any restructuring.
Harry Katz, Dean of the Industrial and Labor Relations School of Cornell University, says it's nonsense to blame the failure of the bailout on the unions.
The union has expressed a willingness to make further concessions. In fact, it's already made substantial concessions. In last year's contract, they lowered the entry wage. There's lots of things that influence and have influenced the decline of the big three companies. And the wage differential between the UAW workers and domestic non-union workers in the so-called transplant is a very, very minor, almost insignificant aspect of that decline.
Katz says bad business models are more to blame than the workers. Senator Croker says right now there are no plans to revisit the issue, and now the White House has indicated that the Treasury may use funds from the $700 billion bailout to help revive U.S. automakers. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
After a 14-year-long fight for unionization, meatpacking workers in North Carolina approved representation with the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union. The vote was 2,041 to 1,879. Workers and labor advocates have battled with Smithfield management for more than a dozen years to get better working conditions, often under intense and intimidating circumstances. During a previous union vote, the company used local law enforcement to intimidate workers and union supporters. Meanwhile, workers complained of ongoing threats to their safety and the company's repeated refusal to compensate workers for injuries on the job. FSRN producer Catherine Comp traveled to Tar Heel last year to interview workers and labor advocates. UFCW's Eduardo Peña told her that unionization for Smithfield workers could be significant for workers throughout the South.
When you look at what's going on here and how you're changing lives and making lives better, it goes beyond the union. It's really changing people's life. It goes, you know, how you're building communities, how you're building trust among people who are different from each other, how you're building, you know, how you raising questions about healthcare, about all kinds of stuff. That if an institution like a labor union, like the UFCW, wouldn't be here, it wouldn't be happening. Especially when once this process is done and over with, you're going to have a local union in the South composed of African-American and Latino or immigrant workers. It's going to have the ability to bargain collectively with the largest meatpacking plant in the world. So Smithfield Packing will have to sit down in front of this group of workers and negotiate a contract and provide what example is that going to send to all the other meatpacking plants in the area? What an example is that going to send to, you know, places like South Carolina, places like all the other meatpacking sites you would draw?
With high turnover rate at Smithfield, many workers weren't around during the previous organizing campaigns in the 90s, but some workers persisted, including Ronnie Ann Simmons, an employee for 13 years. In a statement, Simmons said, quote, "This moment has been a long time coming. We stuck together, and now we have a say on the job," unquote. Some 5,000 people work at Smithfield's Tar Heel plant. Workers slaughter about 32,000 hogs a day, or 33 hogs each minute. This is FSRN. The bipartisan Senate Armed Services Committee has issued a report that blames former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld for abuses committed by U.S. soldiers against detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The report says that Rumsfeld and other top Bush officials are directly responsible for worse abuse in Abu Ghraib and beyond. Democrat Carl Levin of Michigan and Republican John McCain of Arizona issued the report, which argues that Defense Department officials falsely denied that Rumsfeld's policies resulted in detainee abuse. Christopher Anders is legislative counsel at the ACLU. He explains some of the abuse detainees were subjected to as a result of these policies.
There's two levels of abuse. There is the abuse that includes everything up to waterboarding, water torture. And within that also includes slapping of detainees, holding detainees in extreme cold or hot temperatures, forced sleeplessness, which is much more than just getting a bad night's sleep. It means that for extended periods of time, for weeks at a time, holding people in stress positions, which makes it even difficult to breathe. Then there were our abuse that was caused, and the report highlights this, that there was a permissive environment that was also created, an environment of anything goes, so that there were people who were in the field, either soldiers, contractors, CIA agents, who were poorly trained, but were also getting the message from the top that it's a permissive environment and do whatever you think you need to do. And from that came even worse abuse, which also included at least several deaths that have been characterized by the government itself as homicides.
The report flatly counters the Bush administration's claims that intense interrogation has somehow made the country safer. But so many individuals, so many groups, including the ACLU, have said for years now that this is clearly untrue. What took so long for the Senate committee to come to the same conclusion?
Well, it was a very long study and a very intensive study that was done by Senator Levin, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, in cooperation with John McCain, who's the ranking Republican on the committee. And they spent 2 years and had five or six full-time investigators who did nothing but try to connect all the dots and gain all the information. What happened at the Defense Department and the kinds of words that they were getting from the White House? There is no real excuse, though, for not having this report until the end of 2008. It's not Senator Levin's fault, and it's not Senator McCain's fault, but it was a failure of Congress over the past 5 years to get to the bottom of it. And even with this report, as good as it is, the missing piece of it is the CIA. The Armed Services Committee only has jurisdiction over the Defense Department. And so the CIA only comes in kind of at the margins of the report, but most of it focuses on the Defense Department, the White House, and to a lesser extent, the Justice Department.
Christopher Anders is legislative counsel at the ACLU. Human rights groups want to move forward on Vice President-elect Joe Biden's plan to bring in an outside special prosecutor, independent of the Attorney General, to get to the bottom of what happened and to charge those who committed crimes. It's Friday, and we begin wrapping up our week-long series commemorating the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by taking a look at two issues today: workers here in the United States and the struggle to bring justice to victims of a brutal dictatorship. First, we'll go to New York, where children of domestic workers and those raised by nannies recently got together at the steps of City Hall to express support for those who are raising them. The children and their families are calling on New York State lawmakers to pass a Bill of Rights, first introduced to the state legislature in 2004. The bill was issued by Domestic Workers United, a membership-based organization fighting for power, respect, and fair labor standards for domestic workers. FSRN's Christine Lewis reports from New York.
In honor of International Human Rights Day, several children of domestic workers and children raised by nannies gathered at the steps of City Hall to tell lawmakers the difficult conditions their mothers and caregivers are faced with during this time of economic crisis. Kimberly Lopez is a seven-year-old who attended the vigil with her mother.
My mother is a hard worker and she needs some more money. She's very broken. I really don't really like when she's like this. I really want to give my mother some money too, so my family can have more power. And my mother really works hard in the day and night. I really want fairness, and fairness for the whole world.
In the New York area, there are more than 200,000 domestic workers. Many of them work under harsh conditions, lacking benefits or job security, and sometimes subjected to verbal or physical abuse. According to Human Rights Watch, domestic work is typically excluded from standard labor protections, and governments fail to monitor recruitment practices that impose heavy debt burdens or misinform the workers about their jobs. Priscilla Gonzalez is an organizer with Domestic Workers United. Her mother has been a domestic worker for more than 20 years.
My mom has endured disrespectful treatment, low wages, no contract, and workplace injuries. One employer made fun of her accent by mimicking her, but through muffled tears, she said she needed to stay, that we needed the money.
On Tuesday, the eve of International Human Rights Day, the New York City Council passed a resolution urging the state legislature to consider legislative proposals intended to provide better workplace protections for domestic workers. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I am Christine Lewis with the Community News Production Institute.
That was Christine Lewis, a domestic worker and reporter working in New York City. Lewis is also a member of the Domestic Workers Union, interviewed in this story. We now head to Brazil, known around the world for its carnaval, beaches, and soccer stars. Yet many forget that just a few decades ago, the country was ruled by a brutal military dictatorship. And as people around the world mark the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Brazilians are also commemorating the 40th anniversary of the passage of Institutional Act No. 5, which essentially legalized torture and the death penalty in Latin America's largest country. Mike Fox has more from Brazil.
Many Brazilians will tell you they don't like to dwell on the past, but not Susana Lisboa. She has dedicated her life to making sure that the others are not forgotten.
I think what is important in this history is that we say that these people existed. They have a face. They have a name.
Lisboa is a member of the Commission of Family Members of the Dead and Political Disappeared. Her husband, Luiz Érico Teixeira Lisboa, was disappeared, tortured, and murdered under the Brazilian dictatorship. She spoke this week at an event and photo exhibit honoring those, like her husband, who were killed.
I couldn't look at the photos of the dead companions there because I knew most of them. I was a member of the National Liberation Action, the same organization which Aurora Maria Nascimento Furtado participated, the girl with the long hair that appears dead in that picture. She was detained in Rio de Janeiro and she was cut into pieces.
The exhibit is one of many events taking place around the country this week in commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the passage of the Institutional Act No. 5. Its decree 4 years into the Brazilian military dictatorship is considered to have been the coup within the coup d'etat. Act 5 suspended guarantees in the 1967 Constitution, increased dictatorial powers of the president, and led to the closure of the Brazilian Congress and the suspension of habeas corpus in the name of national security. By the end of the Brazilian dictatorship in the mid-80s, more than 40,000 people had been tortured and hundreds disappeared and murdered. But while neighboring countries like Argentina have begun to try ex-torturers for crimes committed under their dictatorships, no Brazilian officials have been brought to justice. Enrique Serra Prados is a history professor at the Rio Grande do Sul Federal University who has done extensive research on the Brazilian dictatorship.
The torturers are free. The dictators died. Because they died naturally, the authoritarian mentality persists. The sense of arrogant power persists. We feel the impunity and corruption constantly, and there is a very serious problem with access to information, with the problem of the archives.
Under a 1979 amnesty, both military and civilian officials are protected from being tried for crimes committed during the dictatorship. As a result, there are strong forces at play to keep government archives from that period closed and out of sight. Organizers of this week's events say the culture of impunity encourages further repression against the country's social movements. Annelise, who has to be identified by her first name only, says that she and other grassroots activists were brutally attacked by police during a march in Porto Alegre in June.
There were almost as many police officers as there were demonstrators. There was no dialogue. There were people trying to negotiate, and the police decided to repress, to beat, to shoot rubber bullets, tear gas, and everything they're used to using against public demonstrations. And the majority of the people there were women, and they had their children with them.
Indeed, Human Rights Watch declared in its 2008 report that violence against human rights in Brazil are rarely brought to justice. The report identified police crime and impunity, forced worker camps, inhumane prison conditions, and the lack of justice for crimes under the dictatorship as major human rights concerns in Brazil. Positive steps are being made. With the help of Susana Lisboa, last year Brazil's human rights secretary published a detailed book documenting the more than 300 disappeared under the dictatorship. Lisboa and others will be participating in Brazil's first national convention on human rights next week in Brasilia. Nevertheless, many Brazilians agree that they have a long way to go before they completely turn this dark page in their history. Mike Fox, FSRN, Porto Alegre.
Meetings are wrapping up at the UN Climate Change Conference in Poland, where representatives from 185 countries are negotiating the basis for a new agreement on climate change after the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012. As FSRN's Natalia Viana reports, scientists are discouraged with the slow pace of discussions.
Some scientists at the UN Climate Convention are expressing pessimism about the progress of the talks. According to British scientist Martin Perry, governments gathered here in Poznan are making two modest proposals that could lead to serious impacts. He talked to journalists at a panel on the risks of delayed action.
I think they are not fully aware of the severity of the challenge.
The IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change, says developed nations should cut their emissions by 80% by the year 2050 to avoid disasters like sea level rise, desertification, and loss of biodiversity. But many proposals on the table are not even close to accomplishing that. Instead, negotiators are aiming at low economical impacts. One big problem is that many parties, such as the European Union, are proposing measures that could still allow a 2 degrees Celsius increase in the world's temperature. But according to Rajendra Pachauri, chair of the IPCC, even 2 degrees will bring damage, especially to the world's poor.
If the negotiators realize that the impacts of climate change, at least in some parts of the world, are going to be so serious that even 2 degrees is much too high, then I think they have to start looking at a lower option.
Dr. Martin Perry acknowledges that the IPCC did not make the gravity of the situation clear in its 2007 report. Since then, he says, climate change impacts got even worse.
Arctic ice is melting faster than we had thought. Acidification is occurring in the oceans faster. Because of that, corals are not taking up carbon as fast as we thought they might. So less of our emissions are being absorbed.
That's why scientists here at the conference are urging governments to be more committed. So far, the European Union has proposed a 20% cut in emissions by 2020, saying it will only increase this rate if other countries follow suit. Japan has promised a 60% cut by 2050, but has not committed to short-term goals. And the developing nations want the rich ones to cut between 25 and 40% of their emissions by 2020. Some at the conference say the key to ramping up climate change effort lies with the U.S. President-elect Barack Obama. According to Senator John Kerry, who is at the conference and will report to the President-elect, Obama will set reduction targets as soon as possible. If that happens, the future of Kyoto could be much brighter. From Poznan, Poland, I am Natalia Viana for Free Speech Radio News.
President Nicolas Sarkozy is attempting public television and radio reforms, and that's drawing sharp criticism from left-wing opposition parties and media professionals. The law would enable the president to appoint general directors of public radio and TV channels. Media activists fear the reform will place the public airwaves under stronger financial control of the state. Raphael Kraft has more from Paris.
Soon, French public television jingle could well sound like in 1964 when General de Gaulle created an institution remembered in France as tightly state-controlled. According to Sarkozy's reform, public television and radio general directors would be appointed and dismissed by the President of the Republic himself. Carole Petit, a member of journalist union SNJ at publicly owned television France 3, believes this decision goes against the independence of public media.
This means a stronger interference from the state and the possibility for the leading power to intervene in the editorial content of the public channels. It is as if we were stepping 40 years backward in time when France had a Ministry of Information.
Government officials say the current appointment process is not democratic either. So far, a body of 9 members appointed by the leading majority party worked as the top executive of public media. Noël Mamère, a former public television news anchor, is a Green Party member of parliament.
We shall reform this body so it looks like the BBC Trust in Great Britain, like the ARD in Germany, and even like the FCC in Bush's America, so plurality can be respected in this body.
The reform plans to end advertising on publicly owned France televisions, while Parliament right-wing majority considers public services programs shouldn't depend on audience ratings. Media activists like Carole Petit say taking away advertisements will weaken the financial foundations of public service television and lead to job losses.
Le problème n'est pas pour ou contre la suppression de la publicité. Le problème est aujourd'hui comment.
Approving the end of advertising or not is not the issue. The problem is how to compensate this financial loss. And despite the state's commitment to guarantee this compensation, we don't know yet how and to what extent. Furthermore, the law, which is currently debated at the Parliament, plans to diminish the taxes to finance the public service.
Opposition says the law will mainly help France's biggest private television broadcaster TF1, owned by Sarkozy's close friend Martin Bouygues, and place the nominally independent public sector media under direct state control. The law, which is currently debated at Parliament, should be effective from January 9, 2009. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Paris.
And that will do it for today's newscast. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Have a great weekend.